Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This is another Stock Takes episode. We talk about 11 Madison Park going vegan, the new chef award, we revisit Anthony Bourdain's first article for The New Yorker, and we're back on Bass Cheesecakes again.
Me, lager, Vinci lager, Gareth lager, sometimes cider. So different drinks for different needs, kind of. Basically what we were getting at before. But that's by the by. We're here for another Stock Takes episode of the Food Fight podcast. And we're here to have some fun. If peeps are unfamiliar with these Stock Takes episodes, it's basically where me and Simon talk about news in the food world and give our takes on them. We each will bring in a news item, food news. We'll also bring in something that we're noticing on Instagram and chat about that, and also give a little hot tip at the end, a little recommendation of how we can make our lives better in the world of food. And it's fun. And if the audience wants to get involved, why don't they Instagram, DM us some suggestions for news to be talking about, what they want to hear our takes on.
Spicy articles.
We're also happy to, if people want to sort of give us a bit of a comment on some of the things we say about these topics, and DM us your opinions on these things, do so, and we'll sort of revisit them in the next version of the Stock Takes podcast. So plenty of opportunity to get involved, but we're here and now, Simon. Let's get into it. What have you got for news this week?
What I wanted to talk about is there has been a little bit of a change to the award wage for chefs. This is something that was highlighted by lots of people who were caught out underpaying staff. One of their biggest, they weren't exactly blaming this for underpaying the staff as such, but this is one of the problems they had, was the award was too complicated, was too convoluted, which it is a little bit. So for those of you who aren't particularly aware of how the chef award works, there is a base salary, base hourly wage. And on top of that, there is Saturday wage, Sunday added money. If you work past 10, you get more money. If you work early hours of the morning, there's more money. If you don't get a meal, there's an allowance for that. So there is, it's not just working out this many hours, this much pay. You then go work out everything else. So it is a little bit of work for your HR, whoever does that. On the flip side, most of these guys caught underpaying staff probably had massive HR departments. So I'm not quite sure what they're complaining about. But the gist of it is, for senior staff, they will get paid a higher wage and basically not get any of these subsidies. So it was discussed with restaurant catering. So our mate Wes Lambert from restaurant catering had said some words in this.
You came in to the one with Wes Lambert, previous guest of the podcast, head of Restaurant and Catering Australia. It's a good episode. Yep, continue, Simon. Yeah. Sorry.
Good little plug. So it came in from the 11th of August, so pretty new. And yeah, it's an attempt to flatten out and simplify the award wages. Mm. Now, my argument is this is on top of the original award wage. Does that make it any simpler?
Mm. So can you break it down? Can you break it down for us? Like how does it aim to simplify that? And you're talking about senior staff, but there's sort of a couple of different levels within this new system as well when it comes to senior staff, depending on your seniority. So can you sort of break down the specifics of it a little bit to give people an understanding?
So there's, for senior staff, I mean, this is laid out in various levels and different duties. So basically you get paid 170% of what the standard award wage is. You can work up to 56 hours, I believe. And there is some subsidies then, which are just flat rates per hour, which you can add. And then there's also some safeguards and safety nets built in. It can be terminated within 4 weeks. You still have to be paid more than what you would on your normal wage. So a lot of it takes away the worrying about hours, which as kind of a senior chef is a bit of a worry when you're trying to keep yourself to 40 hours and you there's no way you can sometimes. So you either don't do the work and keep yourself the hours, or you do the work, you don't get paid for it. So I think it's trying to meet a bit of that. But basically, if you're a senior chef, senior front of house, you'll get paid more per hour and you should get paid more overall. And basically you haven't got to worry about hours, about taking your meal break, about whether you're working past 10 on a Saturday, on a Sunday. So it's very much evening it out.
Right. And so did you say it's a 57-hour cap?
Yes, I believe it is. So then high 50s.
Once you go over, say it's 57, over 57 hours, then hourly penalties and stuff like that come back into effect.
Yeah, so after that hour cap, then you are onto, I think it's 190%, and then after over a certain more hours, it's 200% of the wage. So if you do go over 56 hours, which a lot of chefs still would, you get paid for it as well. So it seems like it's a good thing. It seems like it is simplifying it. It is addressing some issues. It's another layer, another thing to think about. So in that sense, and I think a lot of critics would say and have been saying that it's just another way for employers to overwork chefs. Because for most civilians, 50 plus hours would seem excessive.
Hmm.
Not that unusual, though.
No, not at all. Can I put it this way?
Mm.
What does it look like? Like, let's say, for example, I was a sous chef that was working time, that wasn't getting paid appropriate penalties and things like that by a restaurant.
Mm.
Now this new award comes into effect and I work the 57 hours and things like that. Like, what's my salary remuneration look like? Like, I just want to make it absolutely clear so people understand it. Like, number one, what would it have looked like if people were getting underpaid or people were working these extra hours without being paid, as is the historical sort of norm of the industry? And what would they be getting paid if they were getting paid all the penalties? And then what are they getting paid under this new award for the same sort of number of hours of work? So like, say, 57, 60 hours of work a week or something like that.
So, I mean, it kind of depends. If someone was paying you on the books, a lot of what the underpayment scandal was about was the salary system.
Yeah.
So basically you got paid 20% over what you'd get paid if you were being paid hourly as a flat rate, plus all the additions. But that basically covered things like weekend rates, public holidays and things like that. So there was a lot of confusion there that you could put a chef on a salary and then they could just work unlimited hours, which wasn't the case. So, I mean, really, if someone is underpaying you, this isn't going to make them pay you properly. Realistically. So I don't think it's going to really help with actually forcing people to pay properly. I think it may help a couple of those businesses do it, because it's all built in with the amount of hours you do. But I mean, it's I think the minimum on this new rate is pretty high. I think it's something like 85,000 a year. So which is a around a head chef level, or in the city maybe sous chef level. So it's, but I mean, it's almost under the average wage for high profile head chef jobs in Sydney or Melbourne. So it might actually help regional chefs a little bit more to help kind of bump their wage up. I was trying to find what the minimum would be, but it would make quite a difference. Like if they'd rather pay, I guess it could be the difference in $10,000 a year. If they're complying. So I think the problem is it doesn't really help too much with compliance.
Yeah. Right. So do you think it does simplify things? And do you think that, like, on balance, this is, a positive moving forward for the industry that's sort of solving some of the problems that we've been talking about?
So I think it's only for senior staff members.
Yeah.
And you can either opt in as an individual staff member, or if 75% of your senior staff agree to it, you can implement it across the board, but not for junior workers. So if you've got, five commies and five senior staff, you're now adding an extra award wage, albeit a slightly simpler one, but you're adding an extra, an extra layer to it. So I'm not sure how much simpler that makes it in that context. It is a 12-month trial, and I would be interested to see whether they roll this method out across the board. Because if it was this across the board, and there was slightly different layers for junior staff, senior staff, I think overall it would be a boost and it would simplify it. Right now, I think with both levels, it doesn't go quite far enough to simplify it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because it's kind of just adding another layer. I guess it might simplify it if they do run it across the board for all their senior staff in a restaurant with a lot of employees. But if you've got, six chefs and four of them don't go on the new system and two of them do, and then you've got all your junior staff and things like that, it's not necessarily a simplification. Yeah. But I do think, I basically just think that a raise in the standard salary for chefs tends to be a good thing. Because I think that just historically there was just so much unpaid hours. Like, whether or not a business was trying to get it right, I just reckon chefs just always did so many more fucking hours than they were paid for, than they have been paid for. And just the security of, depending on where you are, as you mentioned, this is not really reflective of like a high-end restaurant in the city type sort of decent salary and stuff like that. But for definitely in regional areas and things, the security of having a higher salary does a lot of things. Like, it helps a lot of people, like if you want to go out and buy a house, having $85,000 as your salary is a lot better than having $60,000 is your or $70,000 is your salary, but you make the rest up in penalties and stuff. That sort of thing. So I think that does provide that sort of like little safety net and security thing. I think that how realistic do you think it is that, like, once these, like, if this new award is implemented to across the board at a restaurant to all their senior staff, how realistic is it? Like, as you said, say 57 hours is not uncommon, and over 60, over 70 hours is common. Do you think that, like, owners and things like that, now that they've got these staff on like a new, perhaps potentially higher base salary, will be more willing to, like, stringently pay the penalties that come after the 57 hours?
I doubt it. In some way, some people, if people are, you know, if you've got reputable employers and they're paying people properly, then yes. But I think what might happen is that, I think to start with, this will be basically for head chefs. So most businesses will put their head chef on this one so they can do, you know, as many hours as they need to. Everyone else will be on the old award. So I think for some employers, it will be, well, we're paying you this extra amount. We're not paying you anything over when you do over 57 hours. We've already given you a raise. So why are we going to pay you, you know, more when you go over your 57 hours? So there is the chance of that happening in the future. So again, that comes down to a compliance issue, and this isn't really seen that. But I think, I mean, the positive thing is a lot of high profile chefs like Neil Perry, George Kombaris, some of those bigger companies who underpaid staff, they all came out and said this was the problem, that it was too complicated for their massive HR team to deal with. And even though lots of other places were doing it properly. Yeah. So I think they came out and said this is the problem. Restaurant and catering have listened to that, gone to the government and said we think this will help, and they've implemented it. So there's a great line of communication from hospitality through restaurant and catering to the government, which is good to see.
Well, cool. It's an interesting one, and like if we can put out a call to action to the audience, if you're a chef and you've your boss, or if you're an owner and you're looking at participating in this new award, we'd love to hear about the experience and about whether or not.
I would like to know as well if who had actually heard of this, because it wasn't that well reported.
Yeah, no, I agree. It hasn't been well reported.
I would like to know any staff or any owners if you had or hadn't actually heard of this.
Yeah, so hit us on our Instagram DMs, just at the Food Fight Podcast, if you've had an experience with this award, and we'll sort of share some experiences in the next time we do a Stock Takes episode. And there's also a pretty comprehensive article in the Australian Financial Review about this new award if you haven't heard of it and you want some more information about it. So, cool. All right, that's a good one to start off with, Simon. That's an interesting, very HOSPO world one.
Bringing you the HOSPO world to your living rooms.
Let's move on to a little bit more of a broad-reaching item, which goes back to May of this year. And that's when 11 Madison Park decided that they will be doing a fully plant-based menu at their world number one multi-award winning best 53 Michelin star Art Deco dining. New York dining
Swiss head chef. Caviar bumping.
It's institution, New York institution. So, huge move, basically.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting is when we were talking about what we're going to talk about today, and you suggest this, I had literally just read a review from Eater about 11 Madison Park, specifically about them changing, and it's pretty spicy and scathing.
So let's get to that review in a sec, and I've pulled a few things from that review, but let's talk about it a bit more generally, right? So Daniel, who is the chef at 11 Madison Park, has talked about, like, one of the rationales. He did a post in May on his Instagram page, announcing this move. And essentially it's about a change in direction for them, but centered around the idea that our current food system isn't sustainable. And in order for things to change, that takes leadership from top tier organizations like 11 Madison Park. Some of the other things, you know, that they talk about is challenging themselves in a new space and, creating opulence and indulgence out of vegetables and things like that, and putting vegetables on a different type of pedestal as what they'd sort of previously been on and things like that. So, yeah, like there's a few different rationales, but I guess the first thing that I find a little bit strange is I think the world would that our environment would probably would on balance be better off if it were completely vegan, right? Like if everyone ate vegan on balance as compared to what it is now with factory farming and all those sorts of things, our environment would probably be better off if everyone ate plant-based or mostly plant-based. But I think that, like, kind of just saying that our food system is broken and our response to this is that we're going to make our menu completely vegan might sort of miss some of the nuances of our food system in general.
Yeah, I think it's
some of the roles that animal products have to play in a environmentally sustainable food system.
Yeah, I think the evidence of if we all went vegan, there's some. It's not like everything would be rosy and
fix everything. No, of course not. I was just saying in comparison with what we're doing now.
There's issues in itself. So I think, as with a lot of things, you get two very binary sides of an argument, and likely the realistic aim and possibly the best one, I mean, of the, you know, people we've spoken to about how animals can really help regenerate soil, that somewhere in between. So we definitely need to eat less meat, less food, less fish, more veg, more fruit. That's undeniable. So that this is my problem with the statement that our food system's broken, we're going vegan, is that it's not really realistic to how we're going to fix these problems.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it's once again, it's high-profile chefs always thinking they can change their restaurant is so relevant to the world that it will change the world with them going vegan and charging $500 dues for it.
What are your first impressions? Like, what's your, because I mean, this is a stock takes episode and it's about us giving our takes, but like, what was your first impression when you first heard that 11 Madison was going to go vegan?
I mean, yeah, like I thought that I saw the rationale. It was like our food systems are broken. And I disagree that they're broken, but not that going fully vegan and plant-based is the way forward. I think as a kind of
did you see it as like a, I don't know.
He seems like when you see a video of him, I haven't met him. I do sort of know someone who worked for him. He seems earnest and he seems honest. And
definitely is.
It doesn't seem like an arsehole. And during lockdown in New York, you did you know, turn the restaurant to make meals for people in need. And he seems like a genuinely good dude. So I don't think he's being an arsehole to it. I think he genuinely believes this is the way to go. I disagree with some of his reasoning. But I do like the idea of trying to find luxury in vegetables and in plant-based products. So I like that idea. And I think from a chefy intellectual pursuit, that is relevant. Mm. So I've been interested to see what he was going to do with the food. That was my main thing. I was like, oh, okay, it's another chef being a little bit overdramatic and being like, you know, we need to take a stand as a...
That's
as
what
a,
I mean. It's a, like, it's almost like... Yeah, I mean, basically, it's almost just sort of like this virtue signal that it's like we are so important that it's our responsibility as high-profile chefs to try to educate the world about how our food system could be better. And, like, there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that, but I don't know. There's just something about,
it's
chefs taking themselves so seriously that, like, that they think that I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with it. And I guess it's cynical as well. And the person that I look to when it comes to like the most awesome in terms of a high profile chef is Dan Barber in the way that he, in what he's done throughout his whole career and has committed his whole career to is like his absolute like deep understanding and connection to the food system and how it operates and how Blue Hill and all the different subsidiaries of that organization can help with it. Like, but like I don't know. It's just for 11 Madison Park to just announce this new direction as you know.
Well, this
I don't know.
This may just be my ignorance, but I haven't seen him come out or an article about the farms that he's getting any of this produce from. And surely, if you want to make the biggest change, like what Dan Barber's done, he's gone that step back to look at the farming methods and how we can do them better. And that's really where the change is going to come. And even in the Eater review, I'm not sure if they just didn't include it, but there was nothing about where any of the food came from, the farming practices that these food were grown under, the miles it's traveled, all these things. So I think it's like, and he's quoted as saying that he had this idea, then he went in the kitchen and played around with some things and thought, we can change the world.
Oh god.
and it's like, I just think, like, do this, great. Like, it's great media. It's great hype. It's probably great for your chefs and yourself to push yourself to do this. But don't act like you're changing the world. Just be earnest about it and be like, look, it's a small step. You know, we're a restaurant that serves a couple of thousand people a year. We're gonna do this to make a little statement. If it changes, then great. But
yeah,
it's putting yourself in context.
I think that it's almost like it's just this assumption that everyone in the world knows or cares about 11 Madison Park.
Yeah.
And like, that's such a fucking food bubble mentality when it comes to any type of, you know, action, like environmental action or whatever. It's like, like mate, 90% of my friends, if I said to them, did you know 11 Madison Park's going vegan? They'd be like, what the fuck is 11 Madison Park? You know what I mean? Like, it's just us and people that are really into food who care about, like, I mean, maybe it's different if you live in New York, and maybe it's different again if you live in the United States, and it's definitely different again if you live in Australia. But, I don't know. Like, and I don't know. I kind of also thought, like, my first impression was like, I mean, I guess we've got a lot of awesome restaurants here in Australia that have been championing vegetables, and we've done podcasts with people who have a huge plant-based focus in their cooking and stuff like that. There's places like Yellow in Sydney and, you know, other venues that are really like vegetable forward. And like, I think, when was it? Was it in 2001 when Arpege went to a plant-based menu, and other restaurants have done it? And like, this conversation has been going for a long time, and other venues have been doing this sort of thing for a long time, whether it's at a fine dining capacity or just people, you know, really, really championing veggies and things like that. And so it's sort of almost came at this awkwardly late moment for me, where it was like, yeah, I kind of know that, like, there's all this potential in vegetables to unlock, you know, like the way that it's talked about is like, oh, we're going to finally unlock the potential of vegetables and things like that. And of course, yes, possibly. Like, you might, you know, find some interesting techniques and things like that with the resources and time that you have at 11 Madison Park to do these things. And you might come up with some amazing techniques and contribute to the pool of knowledge and all those sorts of things. But I don't know. It was just like, people are already kind of doing this. Like,
It has been done in a high profile 3 Michelin star restaurant before. But I mean, it's America. It's the center of the world to Americans, especially. So when they do something, it's the first and it's the best and it's the biggest. So yeah, it's interesting. I think it's as a pursuit, it's great. If people it's people are happy to pay that much money for vegetables as well, because that's always a problem. I'm not saying that people shouldn't pay this money for veg. Good veg is expensive and can be as expensive as meat. But people have definitely had issues with price connected to vegetarian and vegan dishes.
Well, we'll get to that in a second, because that's a funny one, because you know, the price hasn't changed. But I wanted to, some of the, like, so after, like, through reading some of these reviews and stuff like that, maybe we just quickly outline a couple of these cool, interesting dishes and things like that. There's this one that looks fantastic is this sunflower butter dish with bread. There's a vegan caviar, which is tamburi seeds. Yeah.
There's a big
red
trend.
Pepper and Swiss chard wraps. There's vegetarian doses. and elderflower and blueberry desserts and things like that, all very much done in the traditional 11 Madison Park style, minimally plated and very sleek and beautifully presented and things like that. So it looks beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, I think the one that's caught a lot of people's eyes, the caviar dish, which is it was a type of seed, I think. I haven't really heard of before. And then obviously once cooked, it very much looks kind of like a beluga caviar. It does seem like they're hanging a lot of stuff on trying to make vegetables represent meat, which I think here and there is fine, but it's a slightly weird way to go, rather than just kind of this is a parsnip, or this is a beetroot, rather than like, this beetroot tastes like duck.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, and I've always found that an odd one as well. I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk to someone else about that, like, because, yeah, I mean, like, why do we have to cook, like, this is meat-free chicken, and it's like, the goal is to not eat meat, then why are you selling it as chicken sort of thing? But that's a whole different conversation. But Simon, why don't you dive like quickly into this Eater article, because it does sort of like, after, you know, well, actually no, before we go there, here's a question for you. If you were in New York, would you want to go to 11 Madison Park and pay $500 Australian for a vegetarian tasting menu, or would you choose to go somewhere different that serves meat?
I mean, like, there's so many restaurants in New York to go to. Then it probably, even with previous menus, it maybe wouldn't be the top of my list to go to. Like, it would be, you'd probably, I think if you're in New York, you'd probably pick one of the kind of classic three-star places to go to and try and go to the cooler places. So, I mean, it would be among those ones, I guess, with
So like if someone gave you a
voucher.
$500 voucher to go to any restaurant in New York, would it be 11 Madison Park's vegan tasting menu?
Probably not. Even if talking about me, if I went to New York and I had this three Michelin star voucher, being that Thomas Keller was like the first famous chef whose book I bought when I was a young chef, and I was like, oh my god, look at that! I would be taking my money to Per Se to have the dishes they've had on for 20 years. But yeah, I've got no problem paying for vegetables. And it looks amazing. And like, from everything I've heard, the service has almost always been what makes 11 Madison Park anyway. So, I wouldn't be against it, but possibly not my first protocol.
Here's the question. Would it have been your first port of call if it wasn't a vegan menu?
Well, probably not as well. So that's right. That's the main thing.
See, I'm going to say that if someone gave me a voucher to a three Michelin star restaurant in New York, pre-vegan, it might have been 11 Madison Park. Post-vegan, I kind of just don't think so anymore.
Interesting.
And I don't know. And I don't know. Maybe this just, I don't know. Look, I can't, like, I don't know. I don't think it's too, I find it weird that I find it difficult to admit that if I want to go to a really awesome restaurant, I really want to eat some seafood and I really want to eat some meat and stuff like that too. Like,
I think if you're going to one of these places and you're spending, you know, the best restaurants in the world and you're spending all this money, like, I probably want some foie gras. I want a bump of caviar. Yeah. I fucking fill my hand up with caviar and I'll just bury my face in it. Like, that's because that's kind of the point in some ways. So I doubt he's not going to, you know, not have people in the restaurant. I'm sure we filled up.
Well, that's it. That Eater article says that the wait list is 50, like there's 50,000 people on the wait list. So whether or not they're vegan, they're gonna be fully booked for the foreseeable future. So
exactly, yeah. Good luck. So it's an interesting one.
Let's just quickly hit this Eater article, because basically there's a few articles out there. Some have been overwhelmingly positive. Some have been, a bit in the middle, and some have been overwhelmingly negative. And it's just interesting, this this Eater article basically just talks about how, you know, like the service, they're very complimentary about the service, think that the service is awesome. However, they just say that essentially there's just not enough flavor in a lot of the food. Like, yeah, it's just not as impressive and as interesting as it, yeah, as they expected it to be. So here's a quote. While there's something to be said for not making a big deal each time the kitchen tweezes a non-Western herb, 11 Madison's cosmopolitan aspirations often seem less smart acts of representation or creative culinary manipulation, and more like a window dressing or homogenization, or in the case of an Instagram post where Hum performs a namaste post behind a pile of spices, visual pandering to stereotypes. For all the funk, heat, numbing sensations, bitterness, and fermented tang that so many cuisines can imbue upon vegetables, Hum's flavors often feel as muted as a steakhouse crab cake.
See, I think the article's good. It was scathing in some parts. In some parts, it was like I mean, very much an American written article, and the difference between, you know, the UK, Australia, and America in the way the journalists review is actually quite interesting. I think they didn't need to be quite so scathing with some of the put downs. I thought it was fairly balanced. The two bits that I've highlighted, the main one was there's this beetroot that's been hyped up, and it's cooked in 18 odd ways. And the article says the beet cooked 18 ways tasted like pretty much any other beet, a reality that's tough to digest when you have to put down a massive non-refundable deposit to find that out. And that seemed to sum up the article for me. And then, I mean, the other part, which preceded that sentence, was Hum, based on a mid-August meal, doesn't yet appear to fully possess the palate acumen or cultural awareness to successfully manipulate vegetables, or when necessary, to let them speak for themselves. Like, that's fucking harsh.
That is really, really harsh.
That's really hard. I think that brings the article down a bit, in my opinion.
Unnecessarily harsh.
Yeah, because that's wow. You don't speak about a man's acumen, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But there's an eggplant dish that they say is basically the eggplant dish of the century. You know, like a bunch of things, including the service and that sort of stuff. You know, huge props to. But yeah, in general, it's a pretty harsh article. Simon, this may be a stupid question, but like in a restaurant like 11 Madison Park, who were serving foie gras, caviar, lobster, and all these high-priced ingredients with absolute reckless abandon, do food costs make a difference in the bottom line if you go completely vegan? Like, does that matter? Because, like, I don't know. It might not be much, but does it make a difference? Like, and this is just out of interest. I'm not saying that it's anything to do with their motivations.
A restaurant like that, your biggest cost is your staff. Like, they would have, you know, 30 odd chefs, you know, 20 people on the floor, multiple senior members. So that doesn't change when you work with vegetables and that's your main cost. Yes. Yeah, caviar, foie gras is an expensive ticket item. So I imagine the price hasn't changed at all. Is it the same as it was? I'm not sure. So I mean, I imagine their margins are a little bit wider, but I don't. Restaurants like that very, very rarely make much money anyway. They're normally the playground of rich investors. And the money's made on the back of the name and other venues and the chef, as much as the restaurant. So it doesn't really matter. And yeah, you're paying for the experience. You're paying for the staff and the attentiveness. So Whereas people might say that it should have dropped in price because it's just vegetables. That's not really where the cost is running a restaurant,
yeah.
to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not ignorant to that, and I understand that. And Daniel Hume talks about how it's obviously not a financially based decision, which it clearly isn't. But I'm just wondering, like, if you think about the volumes and the types of ingredients that 11 Madison Park have historically used, whether or not that puts a dent in anything or is just, you know, irrelevant, essentially. But yeah, look, I think that, like, overall impressions, I think I've sounded a little bit negative when talking about it, but I think that it's very interesting. And I think that, like, one really cool thing is when chefs at the level of Daniel Hume don't rest on their laurels and continue to try to challenge themselves, because I think that it seems as if this decision is just as much a, you know, decision about the food system and, you know, a new direction for 11 Madison Park as it is a decision for Daniel Hume to challenge himself and learn more about different ingredients and how to use them and things like that, which I think is the mark of a really good chef, like, to just continue to challenge oneself and to do that with the ultimate, you know, do it in the ultimate way, which is to completely restrict the ingredients that you can use. So I think that that's really cool. And, you know, it will have an impact. There will be people out there who, you know, gain some sort of education about our food system via this move by 11 Madison Park and contributes to the conversation about our food system that we need to have. So positive. Am I going to rush to 11 Madison Park to spend my $500 Australian on food when I get to New York? I think I'm with you. I think I'm going to Per Se.
we're coming for you, Thomas Keller.
Cool. All right. Do you want to move on?
Yeah. So my little internet-based article tidbit was that New Yorker magazine, doing a bit of a New York theme this week for some reason, reposted Anthony Bourdain's first published article from 2000. It's entitled One Day and One Night in the Kitchen at Les Halles. It's a restaurant he worked at. I've read it before, but rereading it just very much sums up why he was so enjoyed by chefs. He had a real knack for summing up the monotony and craziness of the kitchen in a way that made it absolutely fascinating. And even down to it might just be me in the way I read it, but like the pacing of the article as well just feels like the pace of a kitchen day.
Exactly.
It's so well written, and it's so interesting and it's still kind of so inspiring to see it. The one thing when reading anything or watching anything from 10, 20 years back is you realize the little things that have changed. And my thoughts are, should I encourage my younger chefs to read an article like this when it does highlight the angry stereotypical chef who's barking at people who, is probably drunk on the job? I mean, the first line of the article is, on Friday morning, I wake up at 5:55 while I brush my teeth and take my first aspirins of the day. Mm. So, and, you know, then it goes on to, one point he's, what the fuck is going on, I say, as Omar slouches in the doorway like a convict in exercise yard. Like, it's just him, like, you know, ripping his staff, shouting at people, shouting at suppliers, and getting drunk on the job. Which is a experience a lot of chefs have had. But, yeah, how much reverence should we be putting to these people? Same with, you know, old videos of Marco, old videos of Gordon that you know, every kitchen still quotes and still laughs at. Should we be encouraging young chefs to read these articles?
Yes, I think definitely, because, like, if you can preface it with, this was 20 years ago, and I'm not saying that this is a good way to behave right now, but I've had experience in kitchens like this. It is sensational, and it does make people sound like a rock star, but it's a good read. And, like, I highly encourage, like, I highly encourage any of the our listeners to go out and read it. It's in The New Yorker. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the pacing of the article. It is just like, it just, it made me feel as if I was back in a kitchen during service. Like, yeah, yeah. I was just like, fuck, like, that's what it's like. That is what life is like. And it ends with him in a dingy dive bar drinking a beer. Like, oh, there's so many aspects yeah. of the article that are so relatable. And it is a pleasure to read as someone who's worked in kitchens and worked in hospitality and things like that. I love the reference to pre-dinner tasting where he talks about the way that waiters eat the food that he puts out on the table, like vultures scraping things from bones. It's like a disgusting sight, which is hilarious because I used to think the same thing when we had pre-dinner tastings the last restaurant or two that I worked at, where like it comes out to the customer as this beautifully presented thing over an elegant meal with fantastic service and things like that, but serve it to the waiters and tell them about it. It's just all put on one fucking plate and everyone's just digging into it by hand, just like just three-pointer chicken bones across the room into the bin, like like while, you know, downing double espressos before service starts and things like that. It's like relatable and really, really cool. Really, really puts you in the middle of a kitchen in a busy service.
Yeah, yeah. I think like after he wakes up, the first thing is he's thinking about specials. And you can just see the thought process in his head about, and it's the things you just don't know unless you're a chef, which is why, you know, people outside hospitality were fascinated by it. People inside hospitality were like, I've never read someone talk about, you know, someone thinking about how they're going to lay out dishes because this has got to come off this section, that's got to come off this section, and they're going to get fucked if they've got one more dish. So maybe we can do that off that. And you know how a dish in most kitchens actually comes together is logistics as much as artistry.
That's another thing. Yeah, that's another unique thing about this article is that a lot of people who haven't worked in kitchens probably have never thought about this constant logistical battle that goes with writing a menu. So, that's a fascinating and relatable aspect as well.
One day and one night in the kitchen, Les Halley's. It was New Yorker magazine just reposted it. It's available to read. So I think, have it to read, but I think got to put in context of kitchens have changed since then. And as much as it's entertaining and it's relatable, it's not the model that we want to see too much anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can just put, like, I think we just need a new slogan for the industry, like chefs in particular, especially senior people who are telling people what to do, and you know, which is just don't be a dick. Like, don't be a dickhead. I've seen what it's like in the Caveau kitchen during service and things. And it's a nice environment. It's a very nice environment. Obviously, yes, mishaps will happen. You won't get your order. Your fridge will break, and you'll have staff members who don't know what they're doing. But you know, it might cause you to occasionally lose your cool a little bit, even. But in general, just keep that sort of "don't be a dick" mantra, and you know, read these articles for the fun that they are.
And be a beer stein filled with margarita to take off the edge of the adrenaline is not a healthy way to deal with it.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's a good one. So my Instagram thing was the last time we did a small bites, because basically, like, I am almost predicting that Basque cheesecake is going to be the same viral sensation as whatever that
Angham style.
What was the feta pasta that people were making on TikTok like that? Yeah. Where supermarkets were selling out of feta because everyone wanted to make this viral feta pasta dish.
Yeah. Has it? I mean, I guess it's been a chefy thing, but it seems to be leaking into the mainstream.
Oh yeah. Don't worry.
Are we saying that we helped that happen? Because you know, good food seemed to be copying a bit of our content here.
What have we seen in good food on Basque cheesecakes?
I think it was Jill Dupuis doing a whole article about how to make one. And this is a week after we discussed them. So,
yeah. And we know that Jules is a listener. So, exactly.
Yeah.
You do them.
Yeah. You work it out.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. I just find it funny because, like, for listeners, Simon and I have, you know, a messenger chat constantly going. And basically, each time either I or Simon see a Basque cheesecake on Instagram, we screenshot it and send it to one another. And since 2 weeks ago, when we did our last, you know, Stock Takes podcast, we've done another, there's been another at least 10 or something like
I reckon
that.
I reckon it's up to one a day I send you.
Yeah.
So close like to
that. I reckon we're at a Basque cheesecake a week.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that's just the Instagram pages that we follow between us.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
So God knows what else is happening.
So viral, like, and I think that, you know, the old Basque cheesecake, give it its credit. It's a tasty dish. It's got this kind of nice Spanish roots. It's so fucking easy to make. And I think that's what it might give. Oh, and it's very visually appealing, I think. Like,
yeah,
it looks sexy.
Yeah.
This burnt sort of cracked thing, heaps of baking paper and stuff like that.
Yeah. Good. But maybe when we're out of lockdown, we'll go and try some of the best ones. So if you've got a favorite, if you've tried some of the many in Sydney, let us know your favorites and we might go try them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not going to have to look far to find one. Like, no. So
can't,
open Instagram.
Can't get off the central line without stepping in one.
Exactly. Soon there'll just be Basque cheesecakes. Just, I don't know. It'll be like bubble tea shops in Sydney. Just these Basque cheesecake shops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Viral.
Next one.
Viral. So anyway, tell us what you think and send us in your favorite ones. I'm like, I don't know. I don't actually have access to Basque cheesecake on the South Coast, so I'm going to have to make my own.
Do it. Yeah.
See how we go. All right. Wrapping up, let's give our tips and hot tips. You want to start?
Well, it's spring now, and the weather's real nice. And spring means asparagus is starting to come in.
Yeah.
And like local grown asparagus is the best thing. It's like you can buy it all year round, but for 8 months a year, it's shit. And now you've got like 4 months where it's going to be good. So get some asparagus, get your Barbie dusted off because the sun's out most of the time now, and peel a little bit of the skin from your asparagus and barbecue them. And then
why are we peeling the skin?
Because like that bottom part of skin is just a bit tough. So when you barbecue it, that just goes a bit chewy and stringy.
You've broken off the woody bit?
Yeah. Just peel like 2-3 inches from the top, from the tip. Just peel that away very lightly. And you'll just thank me later.
All right. So well, that's your number one tip for asparagus in spring is on the barbecue.
Yeah. It's great on the barbecue. Just from raw, just like give it a little bit of color. It just adds that bitter to the sweet vegetal taste of it, and it's done.
Anything else on it? Or just well, bit of salt and pepper.
Bit of salt and pepper, like the kind of the classic prosciutto wrapped asparagus. Although it's classic and a bit of a cliche. It's fucking delicious.
Yep, that's a good one.
That with a poached egg, some greens.
Yep.
Lovely.
Nice. All right. My hot tip is, well, yours is a vegetable. My hot tip is buy cabbages.
Yeah.
Because so basically I'm just like, I bought a cabbage, I don't know, good couple of weeks ago. Good
did it up. It's worth £10 now.
I'll tell you what, mate, cabbages are the most underrated vegetable. Like, I mean, chefs out there probably know this and stuff. But number one, I don't know any vegetables that last as well in the fridge as like, I swear to God, a cabbage will last at least a month in the crisper. At least. All you need to do is just cut a bit of the brown shit off it and then you're through peel to tasty cabbage.
Peel a couple of leaves away when you're in Tasty Town.
You're in Tasty Town.
Yeah, it is good for that. And then even when you get to the last little quarter and it's looking shitty, you can just salt it, leave it out for a night and make some sauerkraut or chorkroot.
Exactly. You can make sauerkraut. You can make, like that's the versatility. You can get the sauerkraut root, go the kimchi root with cabbage.
You will never waste a cabbage.
You'll never waste a cabbage because it'll never go off. You'll always have something to do. Like, you know, when you've got it there, like if you've got bugger all food in the fridge, then you can, you know, it can be the base of a salad, like a lettuce might be, or something like that. Like, you can make coleslaw super easily. You can roast, you know, you can roast whole wedges of cabbage, which are delicious. The other night I made, and this was great. I always get just inspired to make something by something I see at the supermarket, at the you know, grocer, supermarket, butcher, wherever I am. I was in the IGA down the road, and they had these white pork sausages, and I was like, maybe I'll buy these white pork, so these vice versa, and make some sausages with like German style trimmings. So I made the sausages with braised cabbage, like sweet and sour braised cabbage, and I made some Kartoffelknödel, some German potato dumplings with a little nice. Speck and breadcrumb crumble over the top of it, and it was a fuck, and with some mustard, mate. That was a delicious dinner. A bit of a German.
Did you wear lederhosen or nah?
No, I didn't wear lederhosen. I didn't have my lederhosen down here on the south coast with me. I would have brought it.
It's back in Thoreau.
Yeah, that's what I usually would have cracked it out. But unfortunately, I didn't. So we just had to drink some beer and but fucking, I tell you what, like, it is rich food, man. Like, it was pretty hard to get through two sausages, a few dumplings, and some cabbage. Like, it was so rich. I suppose I put a fair bit of butter in everything too. But it was good. It's good fun. Anyway, the other good thing that I did make with the cabbage recently is kupu salat, which is like the traditional. That's what my mum used to call it from the the Balkan style trimming, which is just literally finely shaved cabbage with a bit of olive oil, white vinegar, salt, and heaps of pepper. And
lots of pepper.
Yeah. And that's it. And I made that alongside chicken paprikash. And it was just that great little acidic hit to the richness of the chicken and the pasta and shit that I had it with. Cabbage.
Get fun to chop cabbage as well. I enjoy chiffonading or julienning cabbage.
Yep, a nice sharp knife through cabbage is quite a delight.
Yeah, like a knife through cabbage.
Exactly. All right, that's great. Happy days. Get cabbage. Mm. Go and eat at 11 Madison Park. Get on the new award and tell us about your experience. And that's it. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Simon. Yeah.
No problem. Cheers.
See you next time. Peace.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.